Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
The boulevard don't look so bad from here. The moon is high and bright, catching shadows to the fear of another way. Of another way. So come on, you collectors, what you think you come here for? Not me, my life, the breath I take. You looking at the door. Take one more step. You take your last breath.
Whole Foods Market creates win-win partnerships with our suppliers, and we love to tell their stories. Brooklyn Brine grew from a two-person moonlighting operation to an eight-person production force in Gowanus in just 1 year, churning out pickle varieties like chipotle carrots and lavender asparagus. Come have a taste in one of our six Manhattan locations.
And I just want to be quiet now. Just want to be quiet now.
That was just Papa, based out of L.A., who I saw a few weeks back.
Papa,
there.
Can you hear me?
That's not at all what it is.
You sure?
Not even close. That was a song called Collector. Off the record, or the EP, A Good Woman is Hard to Find, which I would say is pretty true.
So it was speaking like a documentary EP?
Oh, okay. I was doing it. Yeah, see, speaking of Good Women, we've got Jordana Rothman in studio.
Welcome back.
Very excited. Year three.
Quad appearance,
but mm-hmm. So your third year of trends and forecasts. So as we said in the past, now would be a good time to pause the podcast. It's episode 68, which you can find on
so
iTunes.
A little less sexy than normal.
Yeah. I am?
No.
The
he's
episode
making
number?
68
to
69. Really?
Who got 69 last year?
Who didn't get 69 last year? Anyway. pause the podcast so you can get some reference points for what's coming up. Welcome back.
Thank you
for joining us.
This is Voltron.
Yeah, so we've got some pizzas and everything.
This Voltron is a new addition and it's awesome. I don't even know what type of pizza. Because it's not a calzone. It's like...
It's puffier. It's got like a puffy thing going on.
I'm declaring it my new trend pick of 2012, whatever this type of pizza is.
Less the roasted red peppers.
So...
In an ideal world.
I want to jump right into things.
Sure.
We spent a lot of time patterning last year and there's a lot of stuff to talk about. Mm-hmm. The biggest question is, who is your current plus one foodie?
My guest, you mean? I would probably say at the moment that would be my boyfriend, Daniel Krieger, the illustrious photographer.
Lucky man.
Doesn't he get invited to that stuff anyway? When it works.
He does, but you know.
I heard he had a great Valentine's Day.
Yeah. The pre-Valentine's Day.
Got everything he wanted.
A man could possibly want.
Let's look back. You want to go with what you were right or with what you were wrong?
Whatever you feel like throwing at me.
Let's just bring the topics back up.
Okay.
And just kind of review them.
Let's do vegetables because that was a big part of what we talked about last year.
Sure.
Did the $30 vegetable entree emerge?
Well, no. But there's definitely been some movement in vegetables. The thing that popped to mind instantly was
Can we
this,
say growth in vegetables?
there's been some big vegetable growth.
We're not keeping score of who makes the best puns this episode, by the way.
So
this topic's still very green.
What happens when was the John Fraser pop-up, and like I think one of the most memorable dishes I had there was this like baked salt-baked celery root thing.
Like the way they do fish?
Yes, exactly.
What a bummer that the SLA sort of shut them down.
You know, it was a pop-up. It was evanescent as it was.
Do you think if they had gotten their liquor license, it would have turned more permanent because it was so popular? Because it was moving in that direction.
I don't know that the concept was designed to be something that was going to last forever. I think, you know, over the past year, What Happens When included, like, there have been a few things in New York restaurants that have kind of had that, like, sense of, like, fleeting quality. They're, like, a time and place in New York City restaurants that, like, you had to kind of be there and experience. And I don't know, What Happens When didn't feel like...
It was going to be there forever.
It felt like, wow, we're here. Let's experience
this
now. Yeah.
This ties into something you talked about last year as well, was pop-ups in general. Are they still going strong? Have they, you know, found their place in time? Or, you know, we talked about Next in Chicago. And has there been an evolution, or are they just still kind of doing their thing?
Well, Next in Chicago is sort of like the evolution of the pop-up, right? It's a brick-and-mortar full-time restaurant that just sort of like changes its identity, you know, every few months, which I think is definitely, you know, in a sense, the outgrowth of the pop-up. I'd say they've probably died down a little bit. I mean, if you look at, like, the big-name pop-ups over the last year, What Happens When, you know, notwithstanding, like, Maharlika, you know, was this really successful Filipino pop-up, and it got a brick-and-mortar restaurant. Yeah. So,
I think the flight-by-night dining scene is just tapered off.
Yeah, I mean, there's still a place for it. Like, there's still something... Like, I'm not...
This week to Tyler Boring's pop-up.
Oh, yeah?
Yes.
Was he naked?
No, but the food was fantastic.
Wah-wah. I'm bummed out that he wasn't naked.
Oh, okay.
Didn't you guys see his, like, big hairy butt?
Oh, that's right. I heard about... He talked about that on the show. Yes, there were some, like, leaked naked photos of him.
Yeah, it was fantastic.
But no, I mean, it was great. I'm just making a list. it was really great. Yes, it was very exciting that we were, you know, down on Prince Street eating at that abandoned school. It was, like, very cool. But, you know, there were definitely some things where I was like, okay, service was sort of meh. The room was sort of cold. Mm-hmm. You know, there was, like, the main dining room and we were in the auxiliary thing, which was our fault because we got there late. But it definitely felt like we were, you know, there was no, like, when you go into any place in a restaurant, you should feel that, like, you're a part of what's going on no matter where it was. But that's just the nature of these... non-traditional spaces.
The supper clubs are like their own thing, and we sort of discussed already how that has sort of
tapered
off. But
if last year was them fainting, this year is their death kiss.
The death knell.
And the irony is that Cooking Channel just put out a four courseman James Beard nominated show about supper clubs.
Yeah.
So I guess
it's called Kitchen Confidential.
Kitchen Confidential.
Oh, sorry, Kitchen Conspirators.
No. But I know the Whisk and Ladle people like that, and I was like, I ran into Nick, the bartender. He's like, you're still doing dinners? And he's like,
Well, let's be honest. I mean, like, sometimes it takes the mainstream, you know, really mainstream, you know, outlets and media to catch up to that kind of stuff. So it actually doesn't surprise me that much that, you know, that suddenly the Jane's Beard, but, you know, Foundation is taking notice of something like that.
And to be honest, like with all trends, like those people who are doing it because they might not have had other outlets found other outlets to kind of enter into you know, either their own like main bartending gigs or that, or they just,
I don't know. I don't know any stories. Maybe you can tell us this, of any pop-up restaurants or supper clubs who have turned into brick and mortars.
Maharlika.
Right. But like, but they were professional, weren't they professional chefs ahead of time?
Oh, so we're talking about people who are just like amateur.
Yeah.
No, I mean they're different. They're distinct things to me. Yeah.
So another thing that we talked about was fusion, aka tinkering, and I had to say you got it right.
Yeah.
Because
I found the word, by the way, that you're looking for.
Oh,
it's just called modern cuisine.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Modern cuisine. All
well,
right.
It's not modernist, which is like
searching my brain
which
for that.
Modernist is like, you know, the molecular gastronomy stuff. Mm-hmm. Modern cuisine is.
But
well, so here's what I think. So I definitely think that that took off. And I definitely think that, you know, it's, as I said last year, you know, I had a hard time calling it fusion because it's just an uncomfortable word to sit in my mouth. But I think that the big thing that's happened is that, like, restaurants have sort of, like, flouted the rules, right? Like, we're paying less attention to the things that, you know, a Western, you know, continental restaurant needs to do, or some kind of, you know, that an Asian restaurant needs to follow, like, these particular rules. Like, it's just, we've sort of, like, blown open
it's like,
what a restaurant can play with in terms of flavors and identity.
Well, when we had Baum & White on here back in December, they Baum & White, apologies, they had talked about one of their big things for 2011, 2012 is everything on a global plate. So it's not just, so it's not really fusion. It's like the whole world gets in on it. It's not just one versus another. It's like, well, maybe you have 10 different things that just happen to be so come together. So.
And the thing is, like, it still has to be handled well. I mean, you know, you look at, there are restaurants that are doing things that are really surprising, like Parm, for example, you know, has this, my favorite thing that I ate there was this, like, Chinese food feast that they do on Sundays. It's like sticky pork ribs and fried rice and whatever. And to
we
me, that
to
was,
to that. Which
that
is
was
a bit
the
of
most
a nod
interesting.
To their location.
Sure. Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, there's a reason that they're doing it, and, you know, it does stand out from the rest of the menu, but they handle it so well that you trust that you're in the right hands. I mean, I don't want this to be like a call to action to, like, every restaurant to, you know, be doing, you know, scallop Saint-Jacques and, you know, like Bosom. Like, we have to kind of, like, well, think about it in an intellectual framework.
I mean, if you put it in the framework of postmodern art, there are some really amazing pieces of work that came out that take the elements of all these different surrealism and, you know, things like that, or it took, you know, classical painting and added, you know, pointillism to it, things like that. But, you know, the majority of it was terrible. You know, but it was really the masters who understood that, like, I know what to take from each culture and really elevate it to a new form of cuisine. But for the most part, people are going to, you know, they'll experiment and they'll without the classical training and a good base, they'll miss.
Right. Well, that's the thing. I mean, like, the best places that are doing this kind of food are doing these sort of, like, impressionistic.
Name check?
Well, the place that just leapt to my mind is Kinshop.
Mm-hmm. We talked about last year.
We did.
Yeah.
Okay. So
who's new? We talked about Kinshop.
Yeah,
he was just getting. It was like just getting going.
Yeah. Well, I need to think a little bit more about that. But I mean, like, Kinshop is a place that is definitely, you know, like, there's like this. It's a Thai restaurant, but it's sort of, it has this kind of interesting, you know, Western, Eastern identity that's, like, this really smart way to take, like, the flavors of one culture and the technique of another culture and kind of, like, mash them together and come up with something new that's familiar and also fresh.
I mean, we could say Issa does that.
Issa, do you think it's a global restaurant?
I mean, it could just be me, but I can't put one genre of food on there. Like, when I think of Issa cuisine, I just think of Issa cuisine. Like, I never go and be like, oh, I'm in the mood for this, like, let's go here. It's sort of just like, it's always a different type of approach.
To me, it feels like, you're right, I mean, I don't know what cuisine Issa is, but it's kind of, I think of wood-fired flavors, I think of, like, kind of new Nordic kind of plating, you know.
Right, but those are all, but doesn't that play to what we're talking about?
Sure.
I mean, you're thinking about
less, it's less global flavors and more global technique then. Which is still...
Which is exactly what I was going to say. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's why we're twins.
No, but yes, because what you just named is like approaches, but not, you know...
Right.
So, right. It's I think it's exciting. I think it's really exciting because it's great to see the Rolodex or the encyclopedia knowledge of these chefs coming mm-hmm. together and then filtering out to what what they really think is going to enjoy, mm-hmm. not just how high can they stack
right.
things. That being said, I did see the video of the next edible balloon, helium balloon dish. What? Yeah. It came out today. It was up on Eater.
Oh, I missed it.
They made an edible helium balloon with an apple, dried apple for a string.
So do you get, like, if you suck in the flavors, do you get the...
Chipmunk voice.
You get the chipmunk voice?
Yeah.
And, like, a burst of rosemary or something.
Something.
Cool. So another thing you talked about last year was local distillery.
Right.
And the Shanty, mm-hmm. which was a hacky sack toss from McCarran Park as a reference place. Has it opened? Mm-hmm. Can you talk about it?
It has, yeah. It's actually really exciting. The Shanty and New York Distilling Company, I believe, have opened, again, a hacky sack toss from McCarran Park. And they're doing, this is Alan Katz, who is a really well-respected member of the spirits community. And they are, you know, they're doing a Dorothy Parker gin, which is kind of like a bit of a more modern American-style gin. They're doing a Navy Strength gin. And they're also, I believe, they're aging a rye right now, but you might want to talk to them directly about that. And the Shanty, you know, which is this bar that's attached to it, you know, they do serve the booze that they make on site, but you can also, you know, you can taste different gin side by side. Along with the Shanty, you can, you know, you can call for your favorite brand as well. So it's an interesting way to kind of like have this proprietary tasting room that isn't necessarily like just propaganda.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, no, it's nice to be like, you know, choose us or come drink with us.
Yeah.
I think one of my other favorite local distillery stories open is the Bronx Brewery.
Yeah.
With the one beer.
Well, you know, I think a lot of like new breweries or like nano breweries, home brewers, like they focus on innovation rather than the notion of consistency. And so I think that, you know, Bronx Brewery can be commended for like taking so much time and effort to make something really, really perfect. And, you know, it's a beautiful, beautiful product. And I think over the next year, you know, we'll see some more boundary pushing stuff from them, but you know,
but I mean, a lot of our favorite restaurants have all come from like one idea of Frankie's and their meatballs.
Mm-hmm.
The things like, you know, Roberta's and mm-hmm. the pizza, and Roberta's the most I talk about now is like not necessarily the pizza.
Right.
But if you take that idea and apply it to one thing, and that same philosophy will then kind of work outward mm-hmm. while that other one brings the bodies and the money in.
And it's so cool, too, for the Bronx Brewery. I mean, like, you know, Brooklyn has dominated the conversation about local brewing for so long.
Wait,
it's
where?
Like,
what was that? Say with more pizza in your
what
mouth.
What borough was that? Brook what?
It's really cool to kind of see it, like, spreading, you know, spreading out to the, I guess Brooklyn is an outer borough as well, but, you know, it's interesting to see it spread out.
And just one last question before we take a first musical interlude. Still hanging out at tiki bars that much?
No.
Yeah.
I'm not.
That's what I thought.
I'm not hanging out at tiki bars anymore.
That's what I thought. We really caught you at the apex of your love for tiki bars. Like, if no one listened to anything else, they'd be like, well, shit, they're just covered in tiki bars in New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what? Is it still, seriously?
No, you've raked her over the coals.
I'm just saying, is it still a popular trend?
Well, you know, the tiki bar, my tiki bar of choice was at the time Painkiller. And, you know, Painkiller had some changes in infrastructure or whatever, and it became a bit of a different bar. So, look, the drinks that they're doing there are still very good. You know, they're doing really interesting drinks. And, like, if at another bar, like, I'll call for a tiki drink. Like, I'm not over tiki drinks. It's just... that's not the atmosphere for me right now.
So when you're at like TGI Fridays, you'll go for the...
Yeah, I go Alabama, Slamma, Pineapple...
Voodooness.
Schnapple.
Well, what percentage are we going to put you at?
I would say that you did really, really well.
Thank you.
Say like
I would say that the tiki outlier, though, because you came in so hot on that, it knocked you down.
Yeah, but that's the whole thing about trends that, like, you know, when you get caught up in it, it's really fun, and then you're like, all right, I'm done with this.
All right, fine. We'll give you a few points back for passion.
Okay.
Yeah, but there's a few things just to think about that you picked for predictions, which actually leads into some of your suggestions for this year. Startup chefs. Remember, there was like the sous chef, like the chef behind the chef trend.
Right.
That was your big prediction. Harlem and Nomad as neighborhoods, which you... Yeah, you don't remember that.
Wait, I talked about Nomad last
week? Talked about the area...
What's Nomad again?
It's the area where the Ace is. That area.
Yeah, we just talked about that last year.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
I'm incredible.
You were very good.
Oh, my God.
No, and you talked... I mean, you made some reference points to that as well.
Hmm.
And then,
What's the acronym for Nomad breakdown again?
North of Madison...
North of Madison.
It's nothing.
Yeah, nowhere... You mad?
thank you. Why don't you take a lap? And then let's just say, before, as we close out for 2011, hanger hats for M. Wells. However, they are now the pop-up restaurant for PS1, which I think is really amazing positioning for them, considering the fact that it's at Danny Myers that was in the Whitney last year. So it's like, I mean, think about a restaurant getting into that organization. So sucks for them, but on the other hand... We were at a opening a couple weeks ago, and they were just like giving out free
homemade lamb sausage.
That was like,
well, they have a bunch of stuff in the works. You know, they're working on the M. Wells dinette, which is supposedly opening. I was talking to them recently, and they told us they were planning on doing a row bar. So like, instead of a raw bar, like a row bar, where you can just get like caviar and urchin, and you know,
they know we're still in an economic downturn, right?
Hey, man, they were charging $200 a head for their final dinners and sold out every single one.
I went to one. I went to the raclette dinner there, which was not worth $200 a head, except that, and I knew that going in because it's raclette. Come on. But,
yeah, okay.
But, you know, I felt like...
The finest Gruyere.
Yeah, I felt like it was a, you know, again, we're talking about time and place and food and the sense of, like, being there. And I felt like I wanted to be there because M. Wells was such a significant...
No, and that
story.
And
in the
we went just not to one of those final dinners, but yeah, you know, we went. We definitely made to go there in the last 2 weeks.
Yeah,
but I felt like that price tag was like, hey, we need your help.
We need money.
Like we need money, and just like we're gonna do this, and we know that everyone knows it's not worth it.
Yeah,
but it's a lot better than being like, here's our PayPal page.
Right. Sure.
All
right.
So let's. So we're gonna play a song from a band called Palika, who I think are out of Chicago. They're rad. And then we'll come back and we'll start off with Nomad.
Okay.
You are listening to Snacky Tunes. We're your host, Finger on the Pulse. We have the wonderful Jordana Rothman joining us for her third annual trend preview forecast. You can go back and listen to past episodes, and we'll be right back.
Thank you. are you waiting for?
I was waiting for Jack to turn the mic up. And we're back. So
hold on, I'm shuffling the paper. Oh, yeah. This is my you can't see, but we got a lot of good
So let's jump it. 2012.
I gotta say, you're all business today, and I'm not really enjoying it.
Let's
because
I looked at last year's, and there was a lot of stuff we didn't cover, and we only get Jordana once a year. So yeah, I know, but like,
let's have a little fun. Coming at you live from Heritage Radio, we're talking trends with Jordana Rothman, past and future. See?
All right, it's pretty good. Anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. You have in here, it just says Nomad Explosion. So right. As we said, Nomad is like
so
north
like,
of
we'll
Madison.
Be traveling around a lot? Chefs moving places?
Yes, and they're moving to north of Madison. And you're the worst.
Worst acronym.
I mean, it's like...
MITA? Is that the Midtown one?
MIPA.
MIPA.
No. MITA. MITA or MIDA. Right near the Yotel.
Sounds like some kind of insect.
Yeah. Well, I mean... Yeah. Sure. Sure.
So, right. So, Nomad... You know, obviously we already have like the Ace there, you know, with the Breslin, the John
Full
Dory.
Full disclosure, I work there. So
right. We disclose this every year.
Yeah,
I know, but I want to just be upfront about it. We gain new listeners every year.
In case you're
year.
Tuning in, Greg has a weekly job that gives him a weekly paycheck.
Yeah. Right. So
and Darren is homeless.
But I chose this independent of Greg's money-making
just
prospects.
Journalistic integrity.
So there's a hotel opening there by the name of...
The Nomad.
And
that's a great pun, by the way. I'm fine with that on a pun level.
Okay. Good to know. So Will Gadara and Daniel Hume, of course, from 11 Madison Park, are operating the dining spaces here. And, I mean, this is going to be one of the big food stories of 2012. It's a really super, super exciting opening. They're doing, like, 6 dining spaces or something inside the hotel.
What?
Is that right? And they're doing, you know, there's no tasting menus like 11 Madison Park. It's going to be a little bit more casual. And I am, like, so... psyched
I roll
to see what shape that
takes. Are they
I'm
running
so,
6 different restaurants or are they managing 6 different restaurants?
I think it's just 6 what? Different dining spaces. Like maybe there's
casino?
A bar area. What?
Maybe like a casino? Like
a casino?
Like 6 different, like, oh, you got the Asian area.
No,
right
they're not
here,
different.
You
know, really, they're like, there'll probably be like a bar area, a few different bars. Well,
there's like that place in LA, Umami Katessen, who's, it's going to be 4 restaurants under one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be a dessert place. A Jewish deli place.
Uh-huh.
And
who's so, running it?
Who's running it? It's not Ken. It's someone else.
Is it you, Greg?
No. No, I'm just saying it's the same concept.
Hmm. What are you guys looking at? I'm not looking at anything.
I feel like I'm sitting on the outside of some joke that I might have missed.
Well, anyway, the point is that these are like, you're basically taking one of, if not the most celebrated chef in New York, Daniel Hume.
Not the most. One of,
if not the most celebrated hospitality titans, Will Gadara, also from 11 Madison Park, and you're putting them together to do something that is a little bit more democratic, and that is super exciting, and I can't wait.
I'm really
to
curious
it.
To be like, because you know, in like restaurant, in like the and as we learned on ours, it's like mm-hmm. you got to have the salad, you got to have a burger, mm-hmm. you got to have a steak, like half. You know, you can do stuff that's out there, but there's got to be like the traveler that like wants to check in, take a shower, have their burger. So I'm very curious what their take on that will be, because that's not necessarily the type of food that we're used to.
Yeah, well, I mean, look at what the, you know, the Breslin did. You know, the Breslin...
Yeah, but the Spotted Pig had a lot of comfort. You know, that's... Spotted
Pig
is a
lot... Yeah, but the Breslin has its salad, it has its burger.
No, but
you know,
I'm saying with having... Was April behind the Breslin?
Yeah.
So like, but like her big restaurant was Spotted Pig, mm-hmm. which is much more gastropubby. Like 11 Madison mm-hmm. Park is like ultimate fine dining. Like more right, fine so dining... Like then, like Del Posto to me,
right?
Like 11 Madison Park is even more fine dining than Del Posto. Right. That's my point.
Mm-hmm.
But no, it'd be great. I mean, look, I don't think anyone will be mad at a 11 Madison Park burger,
yeah,
or pizza.
Come on, bring it on. Well, and then on top of that,
I'll say so. They will be mad if it's like $35.
Mate. Why do we have to predict what? Anger? I mean, like, we're all excited here.
First off, you know it's not going to be that, because the only $35 menu on there is going to be a heart of romaine lettuce. Per your $30 vegetable entree trend. But you know it's like, you know the price point is going to be, what, a burger probably, I would say, somewhere in the $15 to $20 range?
Yeah, I'll stake it on $18.
Is that a pun?
I'm not making any predictions because I have not seen a menu, so I'm not speaking to any hamburgers there.
Until
I see it.
But I'm saying...
You're saying there might not be a hamburger?
I don't know. I can't predict.
So there might be a hamburger. We'll take.
Wait, is the Jordana Rothman burger coming out on the menu this year or next year?
The Jordana Rothman burger.
Yeah.
What tops the Jordana Rothman
Super
burger?
Super saucy.
Saucy.
Very saucy.
Double patty.
Two types of sauce. No cheese. Okay, so no cheese.
Can I just tell you, this is like echoing through my head right now. There's this awful movie called 13, which was like Evan Rachel Cohen's first flick. And like there's this line
Evan Rachel Woods,
she,
right?
Yeah.
Well, it was Colin before she changed it for Hollywood.
So she's like a 13-year-old girl who like goes down the wrong path, and she meets this other girl who's like also a bad girl.
Yeah, and they're inhaling like video cleaner, right?
Yeah, and at one point the bad girl goes, "That bitch ain't got shit on these double cheeseburgers," and I just wanted to say that on radio.
That'd be really funny if it was Jordana Rothman burger, and just the description was just that quote.
That bitch ain't got shit.
And that is the end of our 2012 trend report.
Okay, sorry. So let's get out of
there. Actually, you brought up something.
We still talking about. No, we got.
Wait, but also Nomad. There's more to Nomad than just the hotel. There's also we probably talked about it last year too. There's this like rumor that Milk and Honey is going to be moving there. Like I've heard tons of other cocktail projects that are thinking about that area, like almost becoming like.
I mean, there's still a
ton
of retail space that's probably.
Yeah.
Like when we walk around there, you see 9 perfume shops and then a bunch of empty storefronts that just have square footage that they. If it hasn't moved yet, it's not like the prices are they're holding out for something.
This is something that I think is going to be unfolding over the next few years, but definitely wholesale district is huge. I definitely think over the next few years we're going to see some real destination stuff.
Is that a prediction? Can you put that officially on the record?
That's official. Prediction. And as I said, over the next few years.
Yeah.
Well, what are we going to do next year?
We'll talk about its maturation.
All right, here's what I'm going to say. Because we talked about it last year.
Yeah.
And it didn't really grow.
Yeah.
It really didn't. Like, it's still...
Another vegetable joke?
No, this is... I'm real. You can hear the tone of my voice. I'm not setting myself up for a joke. You can tell. This is my serious...
Hard-hitting questions.
But now, and there are some rumors that we can talk about, some that we can't talk about, like Russ and Daughters is going to be going up there. But now the rumors are sounding more like reality. So it'll be interesting to see if this really happens in the next year. I think we'll really know by next year if we can see it's really going to proverbial shit or get off the pot.
Right. I mean, and the fact that, this rumor about Russ and Daughters, I mean, that's huge, first of all. I mean, just an expansion of a place that's been in one place for, 100 years.
Just a schmear away from the ace.
It's huge, but it also is really meaningful, I think, because, Russ and Daughters has such an identity in the Lower East Side as a neighborhood place, in addition to being, a destination appetizing. So I think that will speak a lot to the neighborhood, the sort of the needs of the neighborhood. If they need a place to get a bagel... Who's moving in there?
Are there a lot of residents around there?
I can't really tell. I mean, it's a lot of textile and like industry. Like you'll go into a building and open the floor and it'll just be like beads. And I'm serious, but there won't be any sign or anything. You just open it'll be like a bead floor that's totally business to business.
And
wholesale.
Soon it's going to be beans, like coffee beans.
Oh, hey.
So yeah, I guess we need to touch on it because it seems like you can't get a week without the Times or the New Yorker or talking about coffee.
My favorite trend pick from I think it was the Times. Mm-hmm. It was the light roast from Oslo.
Yeah.
Norway, super light roasted, and how they're saying it's the purest way to drink a coffee, to get the flavor of a bean.
Right. Well, the whole thing about dark roasting is that, dark roasting, came out of the West Coast, and it was something that was used to sort of char and mask the flavors of, subpar beans. So that is interesting. I mean, it's a testament to the quality of the product if they're willing to treat it like that. So.
Well, it makes you think about the bean as a product more than just the end result of coffee.
Right.
And just be like, well, how's it really being harvested? What are they buying? How are you roasting it?
Yeah.
But we can not just charring.
We can honestly say, I mean, and I can only speak as someone who drinks coffee and does spend a little bit too much on coffee, that 2-3 years ago, I was still just buying 50-cent cups from the deli. And now it's not really so much. I mean, I feel like New York... It's a weird trend that hit New York kind of late as opposed to somewhere like Portland that's had Stumptown for 12 years and it's been such a huge part of it.
Well, there's definitely been waves of coffee movements over the last few years. I think New Yorkers are paying a lot more attention now. One of my staffers, Mari Uehara, a very talented writer, just did a story about sort of what's new in coffee right now. And we talked about how, you know, that third wave movement that brought places like Stumptown and counterculture,
Blue Bottle,
you know, kind of crashing into town. There's these new places that are doing, you know, that are sort of changing the conversation. So maybe Toby's in the case of, you know, the preparation, the flat white. There's a roaster called Madcap, which is doing this really interesting stuff with coffee varietals. Like, I guess most of the beans that, you know, we drink are Arabica.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my writer, Mari, like, you know, taught me that apparently the varietals can be as different as like red delicious apples and green apples. So if you think about that, like, that kind of blows your mind, right? Like, the possibilities of flavor that, like, we don't really know about. That's crazy.
I think it's crazy. And I think it's exciting to see other regions of America starting to influence New York beyond just coffee as well. I mean, Pock Pock and Red Hook is arguably one of the biggest stories to happen this year.
Yeah.
Let's talk Portland for 1 second.
Yeah.
Have you been to Pock Pock yet?
You know what? I haven't been to the Pock Pock Wing yet. I haven't been there yet.
Is it? I mean, it's... I think it's just... I mean, I haven't been... I mean, he was the only person who was at the Eater Awards 2 years in a row.
Right.
And Pock Pock, every time I go to Portland, it's... I mean, seriously, I'll go at 6 p.m. on a Friday, and it's a two-hour wait.
Yeah.
Granted, eating out in Portland is like a whole other thing, but it's kind of amazing. I've never been.
It makes...
Is it just Red Hook, right?
No, Red Hook isn't open yet.
It's the old Bauhaus in Lower East Side.
Right, so that's Pock Pock Wing, and then Pock Pock in Red Hook is going to be the more full-fledged restaurant. I got to go, too. Both of them...
Let's
my
go.
Whole staff
you
has been...
You want to go get wings?
Yeah, let's shut this down.
Okay, we're going to go get wigs.
That's actually... We have a secret list of 5 reasons why we never stop the show mid-show.
Right.
Getting wings is one of them.
Okay, awesome. Well, I mean, for me, the whole sort of Portland invasion in New York, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think there's a real kinship, especially between, you know, Brooklyn and Portland in terms of the food mores. And, you know, it's really cool to see some of these places come into New York, not just like venues like Pock Pock and, you know, the Beagle, for example, like Matt Piacentini, I think is his name, the guy who owns the Beagle, but also like...
That's in the East Village, right?
In the East Village, yeah. But just the general trends, like barrel aging of cocktails,
you know,
came out of Portland.
You know where that started? Clyde Commons,
yeah.
Inside the Ace Hotel in Portland.
The Ace Hotel.
Keeps coming back. But the Negroni.
Yeah.
The $10 Negroni, which I had when I was out there last...
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty delicious. I mean, again, it's like if you really like that flavor and then really want it, like, distilled and purified, like...
Right.
It's good.
Right. Yeah, so, you know, it's exciting.
Is it one of those things where... If I can make it here, I can make it anywhere for these types of restaurants where...
Well, New York is famously unfriendly to out-of-town chefs, actually. Like, it's really cool that, like, Pock Pock is making the waves that it is. But I have to say, like, if you look at the history of New York restaurant openings over the past, let's say, like, just 5 years, a lot of the places that kind of came in from Chicago and California and San Francisco, they just... You know, they got, like chewed up and spit out.
Well, I mean, here's my question. Are they catering to... the people who they were used to cooking for, like Chicagoans or San Franciscans?
Right.
Or do they understand that New York people, when they're dining out, is a whole different breed of people?
I think that they're bringing the food that they brought. And
I'm not talking about the food. I'm talking about the service.
No, I understand that. But I actually think, I mean, I don't think it changes. But it's also like we went to, what is the name of that sausage place that's in L.A.? I can't remember the name, but there's sausage place.
Worsakotz?
Yeah. That's not it. It's close to that.
Close.
But they just opened... They have one in downtown LA. They opened up one in Venice. They do like 1,500 people on a Monday.
Right.
So, and Pock Pock has, you know, like 7 days a week. So all of these companies are actually coming in really cash heavy, which is really different from New York, where you're opening and you're immediately just like in the red.
Mm-hmm.
So all these people are coming in. They're waiting. They're taking their time perfecting it. And I think that now we're seeing this invasion because... times have been tough.
Mm-hmm.
It's harder to like open things there, but these people have tried products and things, and now they're in a position where it's like, oh, like investors might be looking for someone that has, you know, has a track record that can like buy a stake in it and then bring them over here, which is why I think that we're seeing more and more of that. Like all these companies have their eyes on New York. I don't mean that from an ego way, just once you get there, it becomes a flagship and they can go elsewhere.
Right. Well, that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, look, I mean, New York is like the world stage, so... In a sense, you know, Darren, what you said about if you can make it here, you can make it anywhere. Like,
that's
there is,
that's
you know,
a quote, if you didn't know.
But there is an aspect of that, I think, to these places opening up and like proving their mettle here. And that said, you know, I think that I think New Yorkers are really hungry for something new. I think that's definitely part of it. I mean, you know, they're paying attention to Portland. Portland has this like huge cultural cachet right now because of, you know, all of the exports are coming out of that city, but also like Portlandia and all of that, you know. But I think that like if you look at Acme,
yes,
that, you know, the new Scandinavian restaurant on Great Jones, is it?
Yes.
Like that's another example of like this place like kind of came out of nowhere.
Ex Noma, right?
Ex Noma, yeah, or founder of Noma. And it just kind of like it literally like was like a come from behind kind of thing. Like it just it materialized out
which
of the
ether.
Which
is always a favorite in the restaurant industry.
Yeah. Yeah. So it just materialized out of nowhere. And I think New Yorkers are like really like ripe for something like that.
I have
like,
to admit, I have, it popped up on my radar.
Yeah.
And I haven't gone yet. Like I've heard about it.
Yeah.
And it's all been whispers.
I thought it was I didn't even believe it until I went and I ate there. I ate there like 3 or 4 nights in or something like that because it was just all of a sudden like the hotness. Like it went from
what,
like,
what were the
was it good
like?
You know, it was a little early in that, you know, it was only like a few nights in, so it has a bit of a stay, you know, of execution just because I knew that it was really fresh and we had just been squeezed in on a Friday, that kind of thing. But they're really like they did one dish that was like a barley dish with clams. They're doing a few different pâtés. The desserts were like really strange. Like they did this like frozen landscape thing where like the entire bottom of the bowl had been frozen over. So it was like it was like a pond or a lake or something. I mean, it's interesting
and
stuff.
The
like
pond melt and then you ate.
Actually, Kate Lowenstein, my dining partner, who. She works at a health magazine. She and I like took like pics to it because we really wanted to taste it because it was sort of like
how something. Was it?
It's interesting. I mean, it's interesting food. Like I appreciate anything that like shakes me from my slumber. You know.
By the way, the name of that sausage place was Worst Kush.
I was close.
You had like an N in there. And
I had a W.
Yeah, a W in there.
Speaking of things that are a little bit shaking. In awakening you and things like that.
Yeah.
But also close to the heart is right. This new trend in modern Jewish food.
Yes.
Hold on a second. Is it a trend, though, besides Kutcher's, who else has opened
at Mile End?
Yeah.
I mean, Mile End's not new, though.
No, but they're doing things like Cholent and things like that.
Yeah. We talked about this last year. I mean, but I definitely think that it is bearing more fruit. And I think that, you know.
Kosher fruit, by the way.
All fruit is kosher. Although you have to check it really carefully for insects. I know this because my brother is a Hasidic Jew. So anyway,
real talk on Snacky Tunes.
So yeah, I mean, Kutcher's is like I was so prepared to like
decimate.
Just I was so prepared. I can't even tell you. Like I used to go. It's based on a Catskills resort, you know, that thrived. That opened around the turn of the last century. Thrived in the Borscht Belt again.
Are you ready
the Catskills.
To put three Shondas through. On it.
I was so prepared to like just rip it apart. Like I really was. And I shouldn't even admit that, but I thought it was going to be awful. I went to a talk at the Tenement Museum with some of the partners to hear them kind of defend why they had chosen to do something so schlocky and ridiculous. And I have to say, like I ate there and the food is really good. It's really, really smart. And like, I don't know, they kind of made a believer out of me.
Got a good review in the Times.
And yeah, and I reviewed it for Time Out.
How was your review?
It was good. I mean, the general consensus from me at Time Out, from the New York Times and from New York Magazine, all of which reviewed it in the same week, was this is a ridiculous concept,
and yet, you cannot. I ate there on like again one of the opening nights.
Yeah.
So reservation. So like my judgment is a little.
Yeah.
Like opening night.
Mm-hmm.
Right there, but the ideas that they had there and some of the execution was they had this like herring two ways that was mm-hmm. amazing.
Right.
That was just awesome, and they're. Charcuterie right. is great.
The charcuterie, like, honestly, like, blew my mind. Like, they had, at that Tenement Talk Museum, which they did in October, so several months before opening, they did samples of their pastrami, and I tasted it, and I was like, ugh, it was so peppery and so tough, And I just like, I was like, this is, I mean, they're going to live and die by their pastrami. Like, what are they doing? But it was so bomb when I went back. It was so good. And one more story about Kutcher's. Zach Kutcher, who's like the scion of, the you know, the hotel. Right? He's like the grandson.
A real mensch.
Yeah. He's a, he's in the dining room each night. He,
which,
you know,
which I like.
Yeah.
Which is like a
which really definitely plays into the whole Borscht Belt schlocky aesthetic.
Yeah, like, yeah, he's glad handing table to table.
But that's love it. That's kind of great.
I mean, it's great because so many New York restaurateurs are not, you know,
now
all they
need is like
so.
A live bar mitzvah keyboard player guy like they have at Sammy's.
No,
in the corner.
Come on. I mean, that's the whole thing. Well, the whole I'm sure they will do a bar mitzvah, but it's not Sammy's. That's what's interesting about it. Like, the food is actually really like sophisticated and smart and interesting. And, you know, they don't fuss with things that don't need fussing with. They play with some things that need a little bit of elevation. Like, you know, they do a Romanian steak like Sammy's, but it's not like drowned in sauce. It's just perfectly cooked, really beautiful, fatty, rich meat. And
I'll say their latke left me wanting a little bit more.
Well, live and die by their latkes. That's what I always say.
This is the huge thing with the latke. It's really tough to put a latke on your menu because it's one of those like apron string dishes that,
and that could be it.
Like, yeah, every mother and grandmother,
yeah,
makes your favorite latke.
Of course, and right. And also part of the latke like lore is like its bounty and like just seeing this big platter of latkes, right, with the applesauce and the sour cream. And so when you get like this dainty little latke a little caviar on top, you're like, what?
You're like, wait, I'm gonna eat all that. There's 10 more coming.
Yeah,
right?
Like there's this
apron string dish. I like that.
That'd be a really funny thing if they had like latke appetizer and then latke entree and it was just unlimited latkes that just came out on a giant platter.
You basically just like, That's a wet dream right there.
Hey, Kutcher's, that idea is free.
Unlimited latke brunch.
Oh my god! Well, how many could you eat? Honestly,
don't challenge me.
You don't ask a lady her age, and you don't ask her how many latkes she can eat.
Wait, but so the final thing about Kutcher is when I did go to that tenement museum talk, and I was talking to Zach, I was introduced to him, and you know, I told him hello, and I said, oh, you know, my family and I, we used to go to your hotel, and I went for like Jewish youth group retreats and whatever, and I told him, you know, I got busted for smoking a joint in your hotel room, and it was bad, man. Like, I got in a lot of trouble, and he was like,
you could have really gone for some latkes then, right?
You should have gone to the roof.
Like a tip, like a little too late, Zach.
Yeah. Like, yeah, where were you?
Yeah, that's where. Well,
where were you?
He was on the roof. Smoking weed, right. Not getting caught.
He was stupping and smoking joints on the roof.
Yeah, he was stupping a goyim, a real shiksa, blonde hair, blue eyes.
So, another trend that I wanted to touch on.
Look at that transition.
Yeah. What are you going to say? I mean, how do you transition out of Jewish food into something?
So, a lot of Jewish people work in media, and if we could talk about media trends for a second.
Show up.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty good. Edit out my transition. We've seen a rise as like a number of foodies or chefs now taking, you know, as writers. Mm-hmm. Obviously, like Bourdain, you know, has always positioned himself as that, but, you know, with David Chang coming out with his magazine.
Right.
And more people.
Let's pause right there and talk about what Lucky Peach represents and how amazing it is to really have Peter Meehan, David Chang, the whole Mumufengo empire.
Yeah.
To have this magazine that started off as it was going to be an app and then a TV show, and now it's a magazine.
Right.
And to have blown away print expectations in what is essentially a dying form of media.
Right.
And what a brand really stands for these days, and like what's, you know, now I'm sure some chefs are going like, fuck, we got to do a TV show and a magazine.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's the right format necessarily for every chef, but I do think that what Lucky Peach is a really elegant and beautiful representation of is that, you know, I have seen, you know, more chefs sort of getting into proprietary publishing and owning their own stories in that way. Like, this sort of turns the entire, you know, traditional setup on its head, right? Because you have, you know, instead of David Chang doing something cool and a journalist taking note and pitching it wherever and writing a story, you have David Chang, like, partnering with a writer, Peter, and, you know, producing this absolutely beautiful piece of ephemera, which tells his story in really creative ways that, like, traditional media, you know, because of all different, you know, considerations, can't really do. I mean, Lucky Peach Lucky Peach is one of the most exciting things to happen to food journalism in the last, certainly the last 5 years.
Yeah, you're totally right.
I mean, it's a really stunning piece of journalism and really, really exciting if you're involved in it. And I mean, I've seen different levels of proprietary publishing, like, for example, like Food Republic, you know, is Marcus Samuelson's kind of thing. And, you know, I mean,
that's a whole different beast because that's more of a blog.
Yes, but it's just a different format. I mean, they're just handling it differently, but in the respect that it is sort of like you're taking the chef and making them a different kind of titan. And I think...
Well, I think when you're publishing a blog and you mm-hmm. have daily responsibilities mm-hmm. versus a magazine, which is quote-unquote quarterly,
right.
It's different sort of requirements. I mean, you know, Lucky Peach is really investing in chefs and long-term stories mm-hmm. and research and things like that. Food Republic is sort of more of a...
But, like, look what they did. I mean, the first Lucky Peach to me was, like, such a jaw-dropper. I mean, they could have just done anything. Like, it's David Chang. People are biting, you know? Like, they could have done anything. But instead what they did was, like, the absolutely most comprehensive group of information regarding ramen in the English language that exists. I mean, I know this to be true because I moderated a panel at the Japan Society last year before Lucky Peach came out about ramen, and I tried to put together information. I tried to do my research in advance of it, and it was impossible. Like, I found a handful of books that, like, one was like a graphic novel, a Japanese manga series about food, and it was about ramen. That was like the best I could get in English. And I wrote to Peter Meehan and I was like, can I see any of your research? And he was like, sorry, that would be really weird. But I mean, that alone is just shocking. Like, there's just nothing like that in English. Like, kudos. I mean, seriously, it's an incredible project.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, talking about alternatives in media and branding and changes like that, mm-hmm. one of the biggest stories that just came out at the end of last week this year is Bruce Seidel, who was the president of the Food Network and then Cooking mm-hmm. Channel, went to YouTube, Google.
Right. He's doing the Food Channel there.
Doing the Food Channel mm-hmm. there, which is really exciting in that world because now that is really a stamp on the internet saying, watch out. We are really looking to make moves mm-hmm. in that and sort of like an even more democratic democratic way of getting programming across the board.
Right.
And it's interesting to see these brandings of people doing that to use their influence mm-hmm. to reach people and create like a unique message. Like, if anyone said that, like, oh, David Chang wants to do a food magazine, mm-hmm. no one would, I mean, who would really do it? Mm-hmm. You know, that wasn't themselves. But then you get a David Chang like that who might even be looking for, like, you know, they could, with his powers and with Bruce Seidel, they can launch other people now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, the Bruce Seidel move is really, really interesting. Like, I didn't know where he was going until, you know, until
the Times article.
Yeah. But I mean, there's been like sort of simmering of like internet television kind of stuff for a long time, like Kitchen Conspirators, you know,
Dinner with the Band
and Dinner with the Band. Yeah. But I mean, this is like, it's such a legitimizing force and it's such an interesting way. I mean, I'm really psyched to see how it plays out. Like,
I'm curious about budgets though.
About,
like,
budgets?
Because, like,
they're on par.
Really?
What does that mean, on par?
Like, they're on
the
par.
The rumors that I've heard is that it's same cost per minute as TV.
Because, I mean, that's really
what... But, again, that's only rumors.
But, again, that comes down to, you know, it's, like, where the competition goes. Like, if you want to attract real talent...
Right.
...and famous people, you have to compete on a numbers. But, again, like, YouTube... I mean, YouTube has been expanding their programming game. Like, they did three live streams from Coachella last year and mm-hmm. had five gotten paid for it. They had like millions upon millions of viewers. That's real money.
I'll say this now. The cost of doing something for television, like basic cable, versus doing something for any of that includes a video and a crew, you're talking the difference is almost nothing. Like mm-hmm. it really is the same amount of money for the startups. Mm-hmm. And advertisers and internet are starting to realize that like a television show can't go viral.
But what kind of, well, that's a pull quote right there for the Times story. But I'm interested to see like what kind of context it's going to create. Like, are we going to be seeing the same kind of stars for something like
probably be pulling from like internally, like looking to like who has food channels and be like, hey, we would like to offer you either support or
know.
A little
I've,
bit of
right.
I, no, but like I, the, like no, hold second, but I do model. Know. I do know that YouTube is, no, I'm saying, but I'm saying they are working with people to
like give them a little bit of money right. to create content, so it's like they can just start feeding those shows while they begin to you know pull in like the Paula mm-hmm. Deen's Bobby if they go well, after that.
But, that's what I'm saying. Do you think that they want? Do you think that they want Paula Deen's and Bobby Flay's, or do you think that they want a more sort of organic? It like, depends tactile on star. You
it know? Literally like I think that's when it begins to come down to numbers. It's like how many impression what. What constitutes success for them impression-wise? Mm-hmm. Like, what would they say? Like, when I see, like, a million would have been, like, astounding. So it was, like, for that...
Well, you understand, like, if cable... any basic cable show gets a million, that's a party right there.
Right. So what I'm saying is, like, so it's for them, like, a show that they... Granted, when they're competing with a cat video that can get 17 million views, they're creating content, they're putting money into it. So it's, like, how many impressions? Can they sell partnerships? Like, what are their thresholds? How much exposure do they want? What type of press do they want to get? Like, those are all... It's great that Bruce is there and they're competing for that, but it's, like, if they're sticking by the same parameters, then we're going to see that. If they're, like... our goals are different, then we'll get new talent.
Well, I think it's exciting because he has a great eye for talent. Like, a lot of everyone's favorite shows are Bruce sign-offs. But it's interesting because if you look at the Cooking Channel, like, Cooking Channel is really, you know, in a lot of cases, the Food Network's younger brother, something like that. So it's interesting to see, like, one of the major players go to, like, a whole new network. And I don't know. I mean, but he can't get the Bobby Flay's and the Paula Deen's because they're not. They're already with the network.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it'll be interesting to see what type of talent he's going after. What are you laughing at?
There's an adorable little girl in the window. Oh.
By the way, I'm just looking online for Lucky Peach, just for things.
Right.
The first issue is out of stock.
Yeah.
And it's going on Amazon for almost $200.
Yeah, I read that. It's crazy.
That's insane.
There's a copy in the magazine rack at my gym if anyone wants it.
What did you say?
There's a copy in the magazine rack at my gym if anyone wants it.
I mean, the copy's somewhere in the house.
All right.
Look, I mean, shouldn't even get... I mean, that stuff, you save it. Like, that's another super cool thing about it. Like, it's beautifully done. It's a piece of artwork. Like,
it's awesome. My only problem is that I have hundreds and hundreds of magazine cookbooks. Yeah. It's great. I'm sure it's somewhere. But to me, it's like once I ingest it, it's sort of...
I don't feel that way. I like to revisit it. Especially...
Well, this isn't about who does what. We're just having a conversation.
What I'm saying is I do it better than you.
That's why she's the expert who's on once a year. We gotta just like hang out with her so she tells us what to look for in the coming year. So, speaking of what to look for, what are your predictions? What has not been predicted yet?
I predict that your transitions still won't be great in 2012.
Probably. I should go to prediction class.
Well, I think that 2012, you know, has been set up to be, you know, a year of personal restaurants. I think we're going to start seeing idiosyncratic kind of talents come to the fore. Like, I think people like, Dufour from M. Wells.
Oh, yeah.
Hugh. You know,
it's not Hugh.
I think it's Hugh.
It's French.
It's whatever the toughest way to pronounce it is.
Yeah.
Whatever makes Americans sound awful at pronouncing things.
A talent like that who brought, you know, such sort of boundary-busting food to the attention of New Yorkers and really caught, you know, a national attention, I think sort of helped pave the way for talents who are going to come in and be doing something that is, you know, a little bit unexpected and fresh and sort of like will shake the New York dining scene to its core. Like, I think we're starting to kind of evolve outside of, you know, the basic, rustic, reclaimed wood, new American, rustic Italian, trattoria.
Wait, kind rustic of thing. Italian?
Rustic Italian.
Oh, rustic Italian.
Kind of thing. And I think, you know, that'll still exist, but I think that we'll start to see, again, more of that, like, idiosyncratic talent, interesting, dynamic, just personal just restaurants.
To go back, more artistry.
Yeah.
But to go back to what Darren said earlier, it's like when you, just for Issa, just to bring them back up, like it's like, it's not really one way or the other. It's just Issa, as opposed to when you talked about Kinshop, you're like, it's Thai food.
Right.
But it's this, like, so we might just have restaurants that are just defined by the chef, where it's like, where it's like, oh. Yeah,
personal.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay. I mean, I love that whole idea. It's like, I could try to explain it, but you just have to go there. That excites me. Then they're like, oh, it's, you know, it's Spanish wood fire grill.
I mean, look at that. I mean, like, Issa, you know, Issa was one of the really divisive restaurants in terms of its critical, the way that the critics waited on it. We loved it. We gave it a 5-star review, which is our highest rating. You know, Jay was really impressed by it. I was really impressed by it. I hadn't seen a lot like that out there. And that really, really caught my attention. The Times didn't feel that way. Meh. So, you know.
But do you think that it's...
Because they cross the bridge.
Well, do you think... I mean, but do you think that it's just like anything? Like, it's a new wave of cooking where it's like maybe in a year or two where like they can... Not knock to the times, but just old guard versus new guard. Mm-hmm. I would say that like they have very different standards than, say, someone like a timeout,
mm-hmm.
who are maybe more a little bit tied to like what's going on and what's changing, where it could take a little bit of time for them to filter in its place in the dining mm-hmm. history.
Listen, Pete Wells is hip. He's a hip guy. Okay. He actually is. Like, you know, I think everyone ought to like give him some space to grow into the role, but like he knows what he's doing. And, you know, everyone was like so up in arms about the 2-star review for Parm. Like, it was like, I don't know if you guys read any of this like fallout, but people were like so just like offended that this restaurant
what, didn't get 3?
No, that it was a sandwich spot that got 2 stars in the New York Times, as if like, you know. And to me, like, I look at that and I just say, have you not been paying attention? I mean, like, these same people who are beating their chests over the Shonda that is like 2 stars for a sandwich shop in the New York Times are doing so while they're sitting at a reclaimed wood table eating fried chicken instead of, like, you know, yeah. instead of duck carved table side. I mean, fuck you.
By the
like,
way,
look
wait
around.
A second. Wait a second. Is comfort food dead?
No.
No.
Are you kidding?
Come Question.
On. I mean, by the way,
but I mean,
I already love Pete Wells way more than I love Mr. Sifton.
More?
Yeah.
That surprises me for you. Actually.
I would have to agree.
I would go on the record. Yeah. Sure, he's a nice guy.
Yeah.
I hated almost every review he wrote. I really did not like his style. I didn't like the approach. I just didn't like it.
See, to me, I would think you would like it because he had a really interdisciplinary approach. Like, there was music, it was theater.
Hey, guess what? If I want music and theater, I'll go read a music or theater review.
Get it done.
But like,
yeah, I mean,
I'm serious. It's like I don't need to read about LCD sound system in a restaurant review in the New York fucking Times.
Really? I gotta say,
sorry.
Like, I mean, listen, I like Pete Wells a lot. You know, I'm interested. I don't think he's hit his stride yet. I'm interested to see what happens. But I do think that there's room for interdisciplinary conversation about restaurants, because the act of going to a restaurant is not just the food that you eat. You know, you're there. It's atmospheric. It's the music that you're listening to. It's the way that the waiters treat you and the way that they look and the sort of like that crackling vibe that makes a great restaurant great.
That I agree with all of that. I just don't think this is what it is. You can stick your tongue out all you want. I call the way that I refer to Sam Sifton's restaurant reviews is what I call short story syndrome, mm-hmm. where it's like, where is this going? What's all going on? And then like the last paragraph, last sentence is supposed to be like this mind bending, blowing statement. Huh. And it's just like, God, what was it? I forget what it was. It was something about some American restaurant. And the final sentence is like, or how we've been running this city for like 200 years. It was something like semi-racist and sort of didn't make sense.
Oh, come on.
And no, I'm
Go
sorry.
Tell it on the mountaintop, Darren.
I'm telling you, but Pete Wells, when
he's telling it on the internet radio.
As soon as they got him in there, I read it. I was like, finally, like we're back to like the guy, the type of guy that I wanted to be reading.
Everyone needs to chill out about the time seat. The time seat, like everything else in food journalism, like everything else, just changes. It adapts. You know, the past 10 years in restaurants and food have been some of the most transformative of all time. You know, I mean,
am I not allowed to have an opinion?
No.
Fair enough.
That's why we bring her on.
No. I mean, listen, I hear you. I like reading.
That's me throwing my notes.
Wow.
All right. So let's talk more bullet points.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Ingredients. What are we going to be seeing in 2012?
Duck.
That's
duck and lamb. That's right.
Duck and lamb.
Which area?
He's going off script. I have no idea what question he's asking.
What location? Other than Nomad, what's popping up?
Oh, how did Harlem work out?
I don't think Harlem did what it was supposed to do.
Well,
outside of Red Rooster?
Levan Bakery.
Okay.
Red Rooster.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think...
We only asked... Last year we asked for one, you gave us two. Your right. first one was Nomad, so...
Nomad,
we're going to give it to you.
No, because Nomad's still not crackling this year. You put that in as a long-term bet.
Okay, how about this?
Okay.
How about this? Park Slope.
Like a resurgence?
Resurgence.
Like with Talde?
Terroir, Talde.
Yeah, I'll give it to you. Been to Talde a bunch of times, love it.
Terroir, big. Big for the hood.
Yeah, I'll give it to you.
For our music fans who don't know the restaurant, do you want to explain what it
Talde?
Is?
Talde?
No.
The other one.
Terroir.
Oh, terroir.
Which is a great food pun.
Is a wine bar owned by
Yeah.
owned by Paul Greco and Marco Canora. That's basically, it's just this sort of like anarchic place that, you know, was kind of trying to redefine the conversation surrounding wine and strip it of its snobbery and get everybody on board with Riesling and whatnot. So there's a few different locations. There's one in the East Village, one in, I believe, the West Village or Tribeca, actually. Murray Hill and now Park Slope, so that'll be pretty big.
Chef to look for?
I want to see where Ignacio Matos at ISA does go over the next year.
Hopefully only up and up.
I'd be interested to check back in with him and see how that's kind of matured.
Do they get an official Times review, or they just get a 25 and under?
I don't think they got a 25 and under.
They just got like a mention?
No, I think they got a review. I'd have to look into it.
I gotta look.
But another chef, you know, I think that is really interesting. His story would be Alex Stupak, I think.
Empeyon.
You know, Empeyon.
Which was a pick last year.
You talked about it last year, too. Yeah, well, he's opening a new restaurant called Empeyon Cocina. And it's no tacos. It's just the regional cuisines of Mexico. Really interesting. I'm really excited to see like what his research has bore.
We'll see how long no tacos stay on the menu.
You are a cynic. You are cynical.
It's not cynical. Look, it's not cynic. It's a total reality. It's like it's a reality thing. It's a reality thing. But go on. You're telling me they're going to serve no tortillas whatsoever.
She didn't say no tortillas. She said no tacos.
No tacos. Okay. Anyway. He's doing it. Mexico is a really diverse, has a really diverse and interesting food culture. And all anybody really thinks about is like, you know, tacos and guacamole and whatever. And that's really unfair. And I think that he could be, you know, the voice of all of those, of that diversity and bring some interesting new conversations to light.
No, it would be, not to be cynical, but it would be great to really explore Mexican cuisine that isn't toxic. Yeah. That place, La Casita Mexicana,
right,
which is out in Bell, Los Angeles, hands down my favorite, it's like a no taco, no burrito.
Because here's the thing, for that new restaurant, which literally just opened last week, like if Alex put tacos on the menu, that's what they're going to order. Like that's, you know,
right.
Like it's, we also have to kind of like, I respect him for challenging the diner. I respect him for opening a place and saying, look, I got tacos on the west side and I've got this going on and this is going to be a place where we're going to like dig a little deeper and see what else there is. You know, it remains to be seen how it plays out. You know, I have to taste the food. I have to think about the food, but you know, that's great. I mean, if he put tacos on the menu, then people would just be coming there and eating barbacoa tacos, and that would be the end of the conversation. Instead, he's doing something bold, and I think that's commendable.
I would agree. Let's get one shot in the dark, throw it on the wall, see if it sticks. Prediction.
Yeah, what's going to happen? Is it micro desserts? Do you remember that Times article?
Oh, God.
Oh, can I have the 2-centimeter cannoli, please? Thanks.
Have you ever ordered a micro dessert?
No,
I'd never heard of it.
Yes, you have.
Like bite-sized cupcakes.
Oh. It's not that small.
That's what she said.
All right, let's get out there. We will not hold you to it. This is just
We might.
You can, but this is the like, let's just see, like, you know, you have an inkling, it might not work out, like spider sense type thing.
Your pick last year was Woodfire Grill for this sort of question.
Was it really?
Yeah.
And I killed that.
Yeah.
Oh my God, I totally killed
that. Find your confidence.
I want to say like Pisco. I want to say like Pisco and Peru. That's
Jack, our engineer, is nodding.
That's already, popular. Peruvian food is the new pick for the hot cuisine.
Is it?
Yeah, the Baum and White said
Peruvian. Everyone's saying Peruvian. Come on, go get crazy.
Like,
go
deeper. Crazy.
Go just crazy.
Go deeper.
What's
like your shower moment? Like you're in the shower, you're like, I never thought about that. We're not holding you to it.
I don't know. Some kind of weird new poultry.
Okay. No one said you had to think about it.
Weird nothing. Poultry. Nothing. Not one thing. What would you like to see? Forget per trend. What would you like to see happen in the next year?
Well, that's a better question.
Well, I mean, I've said it. Like, I like a more personal restaurant. Like, I like to see identity on the plate. Like, that's what I like to see. That's what I like to see develop.
Like picture food?
No. Magic. Food that, you know, is boundary pushing. Food that doesn't necessarily, like, follow the rules that are prescribed for any particular kind of restaurant. Like, that's fresh and interesting and, you know, uses a lot of different kinds of techniques, both classic and modern, to kind of teach me something new. Like, that's what I want.
Real bad boy of culinary cuisine, right?
Who?
You know, just, you know, some never seen some rebel type of thing.
It's like a new guy.
Like a little dangerous, maybe?
Or a new chick.
A new chick would be rad.
That'd be great. It'd be nice to see. I have to say, I would love to see some more female chefs come to the forefront.
Sure.
Don't get me wrong. I mean, they're out there, but like just like a badass.
Yeah.
Just not, you know, just doing real restaurant food, just doing something.
Right. Well, you still got Anita Lowe.
Yeah, but she's a legend already.
Yeah.
Like, I want to see.
I'd be interested also to see what the next, like, barrel aging is. Like, what the next big cocktail trend is. Like, what's the...
Oh, we didn't even talk about cocktails this year.
I've read some stuff about, like, fermentation, like, bottle fermentation, stuff like that. Be interesting to see.
It'd be interesting. I think I said it last year. I think the mixology... I know Dave Arnold...
The cockologist?
Cocktailologist.
As you grab the microphone. I would say, I mean, I know that there's the new, like, Momofuku bar and things
right,
like that.
Yeah.
But I really believe that the whole bar tending mixologist thing, I think it reached its peak. I think it's becoming
I went to that Momofuku bar like 2 weeks ago and they had like flames, you know.
Yeah.
With like what type of iron, just like.
They're doing, I was there too, they're doing a red hot poker.
Yeah.
Which Dave Arnold created. I mean, he built those things and they're using them to heat the drinks, basically a la minute. So it's actually interesting. They like sort of caramelize the sugars a little bit in the drink, and they chill the drinks with liquid nitrogen, so the glasses get really cold, and you know, there's a lot of there's definitely a lot of showmanship at the bar, but you know, I think there's definitely a purpose to some of the techniques that they're using. And regarding whether or not it's reached its peak, I mean, I think it's fair to say that like in years past, you know, we had the freedom to talk about these bars in these really in-depth ways because there weren't that many of them, and now there's so many that, you know, has it reached its peak, or is it just part of part of the conversation now?
I think it's reached its peak to the point where now it's becoming a standard.
Yeah, the standard, yes. Yeah.
You know, when it's a skit on Portlandia, you know that it's
oh my god, that was the best.
Andy Samberg. He must really love you. Look at all the care you put in that drink.
Smoked ice.
So Georgiana, we want to thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Before you leave, let's talk about the 2012 Food and Drink Awards.
Yes.
Let's talk about them.
Can you tell us how you're going to do your visuals this year? Is that a surprise?
The art for the issue is one of my favorite things to work on throughout the year. Last year, I did. I worked with a tattoo shop on the Lower East Side to design tattoos, which we superimpose on the chefs. That was really awesome. But I can't really talk about that yet. But what I can talk about is, you know, the Food and Drink Awards at Time Out are like my favorite issue to work on throughout the entire year. They're like, it's just this really amazing opportunity to like directly and formally acknowledge the chefs that give us such like rich stuff, you know, to put in the magazine. And it's an amazing lineup this year, I have to say. Like, it's a really, you should check out the ballot at timeoutnewyork.com/vote and cast your vote and support the chefs that and food figures that you think that, you know, really deserve the recognition. But I gotta say, like, it shaped up really, really well. There's interesting stuff. Out-of-town places, really, like, great classic new bakeries that'll be there for, like...
Where's it gonna be?
The event, we haven't announced the details of the event yet.
Open to the public?
There will be some tickets open to the public, and that is on April 2nd, and the issue hits stands on April 5th.
Great. We'll be here.
Well, Georgiana, thank you again.
Can you come?
Of course you
could be your plus one and two.
You could just be each other's plus ones.
Do you want to be in the list or should I be in the list?
We'll figure it out.
All right.
Thank you for joining us. thank you everyone for listening. We will be gone next week for the long weekend, and then we'll be back and be on the final three episodes that will make up the second volume of Snacky Tunes Live, which will be very exciting. Our digital comp will be done and completed and out sometime in April or May.
May.
Congratulations.
Yeah. So May. We're May. Whatever. Anyway, Jordana, thank you. Any last thoughts, parting advice, words, encouragement?
Thanks for listening.
Oh, come on. hit us with something big and bold, brashy and sassy. Come on, nothing.
No.
I've said my piece.
She's done well. I just want to say that last night we went to go see Bjork at the New York Hall of Science, and we're going to close out with one of the songs from the
by
show.
By the way, it was awesome.
It was amazing.
She is.
We're out of time. Thanks for listening.
For listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.